So apparently we had a little technical difficulty with our recording of Matthew 23.
Last week.
So we're going to try to fix that. And what we decided to do was just Jeff will talk this week. And if you listen to the two together, it'll actually work. Now, we're gonna at least give you a little summary of what we said about Matthew 23 and go into Matthew 24 to make sure we got at least a little bit of that covered with both voices in it.
And this will actually work all right, because in some ways, as you know, the gospel's building, you can actually piggyback 23 into 24.
Well, we're in the last week.
Yep.
And I think what we started out saying, which is probably on there because I think I said it, is that the tenor of all of the discourses and the interactions really seems to be getting darker and more intense as we move through the week. And 23 is a good example.
Well, this is where Jesus kind of drops a nuclear bomb, because he basically, you know, says you're going to hell. You know, this woe to you, woe to you, woe to you, which in the Bible, especially when God, as Jesus is speaking, I mean, that's basically saying you're going to be damned. You're going to be destroyed. This is, you know, this is catastrophic for you. And then he literally, you know, gets to the end of this diatribe that he's unloading on them through the chapter, and literally says, you know, how are you going to escape hell? I mean, it's pretty stark and strong. And so you're given that you're into the laments and the warnings of 20, the prophetic warnings of 24 of the coming judgment, and then the parables of 25 to be prepared, then 26 he's betrayed and crucified. I mean, this is kind of the mic drop, Jesus' final word, as you know, their level of rejection has escalated in this last week to the point that he equally responds with this forceful, you guys don't realize you are literally on the brink of damnation.
There are a couple of key phrases, or key words rather, that pop up in 23. We commented on these in our first recording. One of the words was the word hypocrite.
Right.
And we just talked about that, because I think people often
misunderstand
and misuse as a result that word. In other words, misuse that word. And as a result, for example, sometimes a Christian will be labeled as a hypocrite because they have done something that is inconsistent with the teaching of Jesus.
Right.
So in the minds of some people in the world, anytime your behavior doesn't line up with what Jesus would want you to do, you're a hypocrite. And I think that's different than what Jesus is describing here in Matthew 23. And so it might be helpful just to talk about what a hypocrite is. It isn't someone who has made a mistake, who knows the standard, what it is, and desires to live up the standard and fails to meet it.
Right. I mean, you know, even when Nathan confronts David, he doesn't call him a hypocrite. Because, you know, David, obviously, there was a darkness and a weakness in David's heart and mind that allowed that catastrophic sin to happen. But at the same time, there still was a genuineness of David's faith that's shown in the nature of his repentance when he's confronted and admonished by Nathan. And once he, you know, once thou art the man hits, he immediately, you know, no blame shifting, no excuse making, owns the enormity of what he's done, you know, as opposed to King Saul, who he'll, and so that's the thing, you know, ultimately a hypocrite, especially as Jesus is using it here, it's somebody who's play acting, you know, on the outside.
Yeah, that's in the definitions a lot.
Yeah,
the word actor.
Back in the old Greek, you know, or origins of that. Yeah, it's somebody who's play acting a part that they really aren't on the inside. And that's why, again, as chapter 23 goes on, he talks about them as whitewashed tombs.
Yeah, I was thinking about that in 27.
Yeah, that you know, the essence of hypocrisy, that outside you want to appear beautiful, you know, it's you forget that it's death and decay and darkness on the inside.
Right.
And so these, you know, and of course, I mean, he's escalated to that point because that comes later in the chapter, but, you know, this whole, you talk a good game about the law and keeping the law, but here you are, the law was so concerned about, for instance, care of widows, and you're devouring the widows.
Right.
You know, you talk a really good game, you love to be seen, and you know, in the synagogues and in the temple, you know, as these really righteous, really devout people, because externally, you know, you're going way above and beyond. But inwardly, and again, we're cycling back to where Jesus started in the Gospel of Matthew with the Sermon on the Mount, a righteousness that exceeds the scribes and Pharisees, which, as Jesus taught in the sermon, is a righteousness that comes from the inside out. It is not an external righteousness based on appearance or mere works that do not correlate. You know, that's why Jesus will talk about, you know, you may not murder, but if you're hating, you know, that's, you know, there's a connection between the two, even if you have enough self-control not to literally kill somebody. the disposition of murder is in your heart. You know, same thing with adultery. You know, you may not have actually slept with somebody who's married or not your wife or spouse, but lusting, you know, you just like the courage of your convictions to act on the darkness within. And so Jesus calls out at the very beginning of this gospel, and that's literally what we've come back around here now at the end as Jesus climactically confronts his generation. This is not righteousness, no matter how externally observant you are. This is hypocrisy.
Yeah, and it isn't that the outward observance isn't important, because it is.
Well, yeah, Jesus is not saying either or.
It's what's the source of it. Am I just trying to wear a facade and make myself appear in a certain way? Or does it grow from within, this devotion to God, this brokenness over sin? Now we're kind of getting back to the Beatitudes in chapter 5.
Right.
Know, who you are on the inside should produce what is on the outside.
Fruit.
And yeah, that's why they the Pharisees struggled with, you know, their collection of rules.
Yeah.
Versus just being the person that God would want you to be.
Right.
You know, they just show these are the rules that are important. These other things are not important.
Right.
Which kind of takes us back to 15, which I think is probably the most controversial text or misunderstood text in Matthew 23, often misused to dismiss the necessity of obedience and whatever I decide is a small thing, where Jesus says, "Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, it's 23 that I wanted.
Yeah.
For you tithe mint and dill and cumin and have neglected the weightier provisions of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness, but these are the things you should have done without neglecting the others." And so a lot of people in the religious world approach that as Jesus is saying, just worried about the big stuff. Love God, love your neighbor, be a good person.
Right.
Don't sweat the details about how to worship or how church is organized or even details of morality.
Right.
And I don't think that's what he's saying at all.
No, it's not an either or choice that he's calling them to.
It's a complete misuse of that text,
right?
Because actually what he's saying there is, how can you be concerned with every detail of the law and ignore these big foundational principles?
Right.
And then his contention is, you ought to do both of those things.
Well, and that's the thing, because I do think, you know, and especially in the religious world today, and sometimes we need to be careful because we're swimming in the same, you know, we hear a lot of this stuff and it all sounds good on the surface or whatnot. But yeah, not only is Jesus, you know, kind of blowing up the whole, it's an either or, you need both, is neither without the other works. In other words, you will never understand how to rightly keep the law without the values behind the law. But by the same token, the values themselves need limiting principles, and the law gives hard and clear lines of what, you know. The classic example of the day is like love and how love is misused, where love is about affirming and enabling people and their choices rather than love needs to be limited by the law of God. You don't really love somebody if you are tolerating their sin, enabling their sin, affirming their sin. And so there actually is a symbiotic relationship between the two. Neither of them works without the other. You need the concepts that help us understand what God is going for in these laws. Otherwise, we'll misapply them, misuse them, misdirect them. But by the same token, a lot of these virtues become, you know, misshapen by worldly values without God's law to say, here are the limits. Here's what love is not, you know, et cetera.
That's interesting because, oddly enough, those who would dismiss what they think are the details and lay claim to and emphasize the things that they think are big deal and important are, in essence, putting themselves in the seat of God and saying, I am the arbiter.
Right.
I get to decide what's a big deal and what isn't a big deal. And in essence, are caving to the most fundamental of all human struggles, and that is, I want to have it my way. I want to do it my way.
Yeah.
I'm still really deciding for myself, which is the struggle. So he's pretty tough on the Pharisees all the way through this until you get to 37.
Well, and that's where, you know, and then what we talked about last week, which, you know, may or may not have made the recording, but that's the transition to chapter 24. You know, get the chapter breaks out of the way. As much as he has just read the Pharisees, the Riot Act, and literally said, you're on the brink of hell, you know, at the end of the day, Jesus, God, you know, I take no pleasure in the death of the wicked. It may be necessary per God's law and God's justice if there's impenitence and hard-heartedness, but I take no pleasure in the death of the wicked. And so here you see that in Jesus incarnate, God incarnate, then turning around and mourning over Jerusalem because he knows what's about to happen in 26, 27, 28. He knows what he's about to prophesy in chapter 24, that this rejection of him is going to lead to absolute catastrophe. He came not to judge but to save in this first coming. And unfortunately, You know, human response, you know, the Jews here, but collectively the human race ever since. We reject, we harden our hearts collectively, and a catastrophe is the other side of that then.
Yeah, by the way, what that demonstrates is that what he has just done is not an indication that he doesn't love them, but an indication that he does love them. You can do both. You can give someone a good, firm, verbal smackdown, which he does here.
Right.
And at the same time, turn around and say, I'm doing this because I love you. And I want to see you come back to me. And I've tried everything else.
And I think what's important for those of us who do have to have those conversations sometimes is realize just because somebody else tells you you're unloving, when you confront them about the wrongdoing, doesn't mean you actually are. You know, we kind of get guilted or emotionally manipulated in that sometimes because we're good people. We're trying to be good people. And you remember, they don't see this as Jesus's love. They see this, again, as, you know, all the more, now they're ready to kill him. And they will kill him. You know, just because others do not receive what is love, the real issue is not whether somebody sees what we're doing as loving. Does God see what we're doing as loving?
Right. Oh,
that's and so that's what you see here is, you know, they don't by no means receive this. You know, they don't, you know, recognize Jesus's lament, that he is grieved over, you know, what he's just said in 23, what he's going to say in 24. It breaks his heart to do so. They just see it as, you know, God getting in the way of, you know, or a false prophet getting in the way of, you know, as they see him.
Yeah, it made
of what
me think,
they want to do.
It made me think about preaching too, because I wonder how often our pulpits sound like Matthew 23.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, are we saying that there aren't people like this? And even sometimes our own hearts can have these dispositions that need to be called out and fervently rebuked as the Lord does here. And I just wonder how many churches this kind of preaching would put up, how many churches would put up with this kind of preaching.
Right.
And are we coming into a season where we're kind of like 2 Timothy 4, you know, we want to come and have our ears tickled when really we need that good smackdown?
Well, and the irony is the longer we go as human beings, the longer we go between hard but necessary rebukes, the more severe the rebuke is probably going to need to be when it comes.
Yeah.
I mean, in other words, you know, it's kind of like, you know, disciplining your children, right? If you deal with the issues as they come, those aren't fun conversations. You know, when your child is mad at you or upset with you because you discipline them. But if you don't, by the time they're teenagers and you realize you've got a problem on your hands, the discipline is going to be that much more. Is going to need to be that much more caustic, difficult, challenging, harsh to undo, you know, what should have been being checked all along. So that's the irony is, you know, if you're going to be saved, you're going to get it sooner or later. The question is, would, you know, kind of like Paul to the Corinthians, you rather, you know, how do you want me to come to you?
Yeah, exactly.
You want to listen now or you want to listen later?
Well, let's jump into 24 since we're covering two chapters.
Yeah, yeah. The lament leads to what, you know, what are you talking about, Jesus?
Well, so 24 used to be a pretty controversial chapter that got lots of attention. I'm thinking back when I was a young preacher and premillennialism was such a big deal and how Lindsay was selling millions of copies of the
premillennial playground.
The late great Planet Earth. Do y'all remember that?
Yeah.
Any of y'all read that book? I bet young people listening to this, like if you're under the age of 30, probably don't even know that book. Do you have a copy of that?
Maybe. That was one of those ones that was just so off the chain. There were other ways to confront premillennialism without putting yourself through that misery.
So anyway, let's talk a little about Matthew 24, just maybe to give folks kind of a primer for reading the chapter. I think it's largely abused by those who claim that, you know, we can know the exact time of the Lord's coming, which
ironically, verse 36, Jesus says, even I don't know, you know, in his humanity, even I don't know.
But the setup is important, I think. I think part of the reason people want to get into the fantastic detail that follows without appreciating how the Lord sets that up and the circumstances that gave rise to what he says here.
Yeah, so just, you know, a few quick things as you're reading 24 this week. Number one, kind of like when you read Revelation or other heavily apocalyptic prophetic passages, don't get bogged down in the details. That's where you wind up with, you know, premillennialists, you know, kind of hanging all sorts of theories and whatnot. What you're looking for, especially if this section is relatively new to you this week, you're looking for the big picture, and the big picture is going to become clear enough. You know, bottom line, what is Jesus trying to communicate? Mm-hmm. You know, don't get bogged down in the details. Number two, do recognize that like other places like Revelation, this passage is heavily, heavily, heavily indebted to a lot of Old Testament prophecies and language. It is a mashup of a lot of terminologies, concepts, themes, phrases that come throughout, especially Daniel chapter 7 will play a large role here. But in general, you know, the less familiar you are with the prophets and where Jesus is pulling all this language, this imagery, these phrasing from, the more challenging it is to really get what he's up to here. And so we really just this week, you really want to stick on, especially if this is unfamiliar for you, stick with the big picture, what's going on overall. And so, and to David, to your point then, that the setup's important. What is, you know, why is Jesus saying this? Well, as they've gone out, you know, Jesus has lamented over Jerusalem. They're out on the Mount of Olives, which if you've never been there, gives it really a spectacular view of the temple section. I mean, I've never been able to see with my own eyes. Can very much imagine them standing on that, because the Mount of Olives isn't that big. It's a hill, we'd call it in Texas, like the Hill Country Hills. It's not that big.
We should have put a picture on the slide.
We should have. But really, there on the side of the Mount of Olives, it really is. It's a spectacular view of the temple area because you still see the dome.
They can Google it.
Yeah, you still see the Dome of the Rock, Al-Aqsa Mosque, the things that are there today. But it literally is a picturesque place to have this conversation. And so it also makes sense why, as they're going out to for the night, they're outside the city and they're looking back over their shoulders at this place. The disciples are going to say, "Isn't this something to look at?" Because it is an absolutely panoramic view of the wonders of the wonder of the ancient world, Herod's second temple. So it really was a wonder. And so they basically, isn't this impressive? What do you think of this? And Jesus, especially coming out of what you just said in chapter 23, in the lament, he understands that his ultimate rejection by all of this, the temple authorities, the Jewish religion, Jewish leadership, the Jewish people, it's all at hand. Turn the page, that's where we're going to be. He says, you're impressed with this, but this whole thing's going to be shattered. Every stone thrown down, and you can still go underneath the Temple Mount or kind of the side of the Temple Mount today and see some of the rubble, some of the old, literally, go see Jesus' words fulfilled to this day if you know where to look there when you go to Jerusalem. And so he ultimately begins to answer the questions that his response, and this is all going to be destroyed in verse 2. Verse 3, they then come to him on the Mount of Olives privately. And they ask him, when will these things be? Mm-hmm. What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?
There you go.
And so, as is so often the case, we've seen this elsewhere in the Gospels, they are asking more than they realize. And so Jesus gives them the answer, the ultimate answer to a question they did not realize they were asking when they phrased it. Because part of what happens here, and again, not everybody agrees on this, and that's okay.
By the way, pause a second. They actually think they're asking one question.
Yeah, there's a sense of which, yes, because they cannot imagine the temple being destroyed.
Yes, when that happens, it'll be the end.
And the world not ending with it. Again, just like they can't understand how Jesus can be a crucified Messiah.
Right.
This is before the resurrection. This is before the crucifixion. This is where the Holy Spirit comes upon them on the day of Pentecost. This is still them struggling within their framework of their limited understanding and misunderstanding of prophecy. They simply cannot imagine, just like they can't imagine a crucified Messiah. Peter rejects what Jesus says about that. They cannot imagine the temple could be destroyed and the world not end with it.
There
that is just
go.
Beyond their frame of reference at this point. And so again, they think that Jesus just said destruction of the temple and the world ending. And Jesus is going to say one looks like the other, but it's not. It is a down payment on the other, but they're going to be ultimately two different things.
So we agree that what he goes on to describe is not a single event, but two events. And if you want a simple way to process this, now you correct me if you think I'm not doing this right. One is a day you can know. There will be indication that it's coming.
Yeah.
And the other is a day that you cannot know.
Right.
When will all these things be? This one stone not left standing on another. I can tell you, there'll be signs that's coming.
Right.
But the end, the ultimate end, that's a day we cannot know.
Right.
And so that's really how I think to understand 24 is to know they think they've got one question. They really have two.
Right.
And it's about two different days, one they could know about, one they couldn't.
Well, and underscore that as I think the way you and I both read this chapter, as Jesus is wrapping up the answer to the first part about the temple being destroyed.
Right.
Verse 34, he's been talking about that for a while. Verse 34, and truly, truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until these things take place. There are those of you who are going to live long enough to actually see what I've been telling you about the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. You're going to see it happen. Now, that doesn't mean literally every last one of them, because like the Apostle James will be dead before that happens.
Right.
But others of these apostles, John, famously living into the 90s, John, and others will live to see this happen.
It was happening soon is the point.
Yeah, within a lifetime,
right?
This is happening, and so that's the thing is, that's part of the key right there. That this can't just be the end of the world. Jesus says basically, this generation is going to see this happen. This is closer than you realize. So that's the thing is, but again, and this happens in the prophets. You'll see this in Isaiah especially. Ironically, Isaiah 61 is a good example of this, which Jesus himself quotes and says, today this has been fulfilled in your hearing in the synagogue of Nazareth in Luke chapter 4. But if you go back and read Isaiah 61 some more, parts of Isaiah 61 beyond what Jesus quoted also will allude to the end time. And so sometimes prophets see a global picture of what's going to happen. But in history, it works out over time, multiple comings, multiple events, multiple centuries, whatever. So sometimes when especially apocalyptic prophecy is in play, the vision will or the explanation will kind of be a global thing, all at once, all rolled into one. But the reality is in time, in history, it happens over a long expanse of time. And so I think that's what's going on here. Jesus, the destruction of Jerusalem, which is going to happen ultimately, go back to Matthew 23, because of the rejection of him.
Right.
Is a warning shot to the entire human race where the Jewish people will get the comeuppance for rejecting the Jewish Messiah per Jewish prophecy and Jewish messianic expectation, to the Jew first and also to the Greek, the book of Acts says. So the Jews will also get the first judgment of God in the destruction of their city and their temple because they rejected the Messiah. Elsewhere, you did not know the day of your visitation, Jesus weeps. But it's a warning shot, it's a down payment on what happens to the entire human race ultimately, because we have rejected the Messiah as well.
Every judgment does that, though, does it not? Doesn't it, in a sense, even the flood judgment kind of foreshadows
warning shots.
The fact God is going to hold you accountable. There is a time coming where there will be a consequence for the sins that you've committed and the choices you make. And so, in a sense, every judgment that leads up to final judgment is foreshadowing.
Yeah.
The bigger one that's to come.
Well, when Paul talks about the day of the Lord, which we recognize as the end of time, the second coming of Jesus, Paul gets that phrase from prophets who use that concept, the day of the Lord, routinely for God's judgments within history of specific nations, peoples, and cities. And so that's the whole thing. All Paul is doing is basically taking a stock phrase of the prophets and saying, by reusing it for the second coming, all of those word down payments, anticipation of, typologies of the ultimate day of the Lord, when not just one people, nation, or city gets its judgment, the entire human race history is rolled up and ended. And that's what Jesus is doing here is a relative form of that. The Jews will get a down payment of that because they rejected the foretold Messiah that was coming to them. And then subsequently the human race at the second coming will get the same thing collectively because the human race by that point will have been judged like the Jews are now being judged for having rejected the coming of the Messiah in the same way.
So give that a read, Matthew 24 this week. That is our reading for this week. 23 was just to catch everybody up from the technical difficulties last week. But read 24, see how that sounds to you, what you see when you read that. And if you have questions about that, we'll be glad to address those in the next podcast. But for now, let's tackle Matthew 24 this week.